Hi, it's JR. Just a quick reminder, if you haven't already, subscribe, rate, and review on whichever platform you're listening to the podcast. And tell your friends. Word of mouth. It's useful. I also want to tell you about our fiscal sponsor partnership with Creative Visions. They're a Malibu-based 501c3 that supports storytelling ventures like this one. So if you like what you hear and you want to support the program, head over to our link at justdropitin.com. On with the program.
No, I didn't think it. This is not a good idea. I signed up for this. We signed up to stop it. So when we find it, we block the road. We don't run away. But the Nishima wouldn't stop. It was aiming straight at us. We have 30 seconds in the water, and that's it, and we're dead.
From 2728 Pictures, this is Just Dropping In, a show about the global creators and influencers who are reframing the lens on people, places, and ideas. I'm J.R. Byersmith, and on this episode, how Lamia Assembly moved from the suburbs of Paris to high-stakes campaigns to save the oceans as the leader of Sea Shepherd France.
Poaching whales and go back to Japan. Over.
In 2004, Lamia enrolled in a Master's of Science program at the University of Sorbonne. She was 24. As the daughter of a cleaning lady, her mother's wishes extended no further than the stability and security that comes with a secretary job. But this was also the same Moroccan mother who took her daughter to her native Casablanca every summer and allowed her to fall in love with the ocean. A year into her master's program, a friend told her about a notable conservation activist named Paul Watson, who was coming to town to speak about direct action marine conservation campaigns. It was a Sunday she'll never forget, because that's the day she told a man many had dubbed a modern-day pirate for his tactics on the high seas that she wanted to join the fight. I first caught up with Lamia in San Diego. She was in town for a Global Sea Shepherd board meeting. We met just before dusk and on the bow of a boat. You'll hear the wind and the harbor noises from time to time as they pass by us, through the cabin, and back out to sea.
So do you call him, or do you email him after that lecture?
No, I went to him straight away after the talk, and I'm like, I love what you do, so how can I help you? I want to join, I want to come on the ship. And he said, yeah, I remember what he said. He said, well, if you're ready to risk your life for a while, and if you have the time, then apply and join.
And did you stall for a minute? That's not a normal like job introduction line. If you're ready to risk your life for a whale, come
on
board.
Yeah, I am. And at that time, I had never seen a whale. But for me, it was like there was no question about it.
In 1982, the International Whaling Commission decided that there should be a pause in commercial whaling on all whale species from 1986 on. This pause is often referred to as the commercial whaling moratorium, and it remains in place today. Here's the problem. Much like the Paris Climate Accords, this requires cooperation from everyone. Iceland and Norway, they set their own limits, so that's a challenge. Russia objects to the moratorium altogether. And then there's Japan, who annually, under the guise of scientific research, sends a massive fleet into the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary near Antarctica. The effort to draw attention to this ruse and stop it was the genesis of the runaway reality TV hit Whale Wars. 2 years before the show was picked up, and just months after meeting Paul Watson at the talk, Lamia was on board as a quartermaster, chasing the main target, the Nishan Maru.
This is Japan Coast Guard officer on board, Nishan Maru. I warn you, stop your obstructive actions immediately.
It was a miracle, but we found the Nishan Maru on Christmas Eve, and there was a storm that day with a swell of like 8 meters. It was pretty bad. And Paul, being Paul, decided, okay, we're gonna block the road of the Nishan Maru. We're gonna put our vessel in front of him. And we were like 10 times smaller. For us, it was like seeing the devil. Like it exists, it's really there, you know, because we've been studying so much. And that's it, Paul said, okay, we're heading for it. And we're like...
Did you feel like you were going into battle, or did you feel like, oh my God, this is not a good idea?
No, I didn't think it, this is not a good idea. I signed up for this. We signed up to stop it. So when we find it, we block the road. We don't run away, because otherwise we could have stayed at home. But the Nishimaru wouldn't stop. It was aiming straight at us and putting its alarm system. And we were in the middle of nowhere in the Antarctic Ocean with no one to rescue us, with a swell of 8 meters. And we're like, okay, when the hit is gonna happen, we have 30 seconds in the water, and that's it, and we're dead. And we're gonna sink, for sure. And I remember Peter Hammerstedt coming and telling us, okay, collision in 2 minutes. Right. And that day I thought, okay, that's it, we're gonna die. All right, it was fun.
When that Mauru boat's sitting in front of you, like, you've gone all the way to that place, but then I'm wondering, some people are looking that clearly and be like, oh, hey, they're out there to fish. You know, they're out there to get their own lot, you know, to get their, you know, to do their industry. So, but whaling is different, especially, like, there's an evolution that you're about to get to that's important.
Whaling is different. Whaling is different in that way that whales have that conscience and how to say that magic about them that makes the world like a more magical place. It sounds a bit weird like that, but what I mean by that, it's not that it's for me, it's not, I don't make a real difference between killing whales and killing fish, but it's just that in a world where whales have such a charisma, we keep on killing whales, we won't save anything else. How can you try to save tuna or sea cucumbers if you cannot even save whales and dolphins and seals that have such a capital sympathy, you know? People love them. And you cannot even save these, you cannot even spare these ones. You're not gonna save anything else. And
how bad are the numbers?
Well, the numbers of whales have dropped, like, it depends on the species. If you take blue whales, we lost 99% of blue whales. It really depends on the species. But the thing is, whales today are facing so many threats, like global warming, overfishing, bycatch, acidification of the ocean.
Plastics,
of course, plastics is a big one. Come on, let's stop targeting them willingly, you know? It's very difficult to stop climate change. You don't push a button and you stop climate change, right? But you can stop that fucking harpoon, right? It's easy, you just have to decide it, that's it. And if we cannot even do that, then how are we gonna fight all these major causes that are so harder to get onto? It's like the minimum. It's the first necessary step that we have to do if we won't have a chance to save the ocean. And by saving the ocean, we mean, of course, saving ourselves. Because we feel disconnected from the ocean, but there is no life on Earth without the ocean. We won't be here to see a planet with a dead ocean. So we say we have to save the ocean, or we don't want to live in a world without whales. But what I think is we won't be able to see a world without whales, because if we cannot save whales, we cannot save the ocean. And if we cannot save the oceans, that means we're gone.
If you've never heard a humpback whale, you can understand why Lamia's in this fight. It's kind of magic. Here's a sample from BBC Earth.
Male humpback whales repeat each other's songs and add to them so they become ever more complex and beautiful, showing off their memory as well as sheer volume.
The key is to make people realize that we are intimately connected to the ocean. And it doesn't matter if you live by the ocean or in a suburb of Paris or in the desert, your life is completely and directly linked to the fact that the ocean is alive. And why the ocean is alive? Because of marine life, of course. What keeps the ocean alive? What keeps the ocean functioning? It's marine life. The ocean is the first climate regulator before the forest. It's our first source of oxygen. More than half of the oxygen that we are breathing comes from the ocean. So when I talk to you, one breath out of two, I own it to marine life. I own it to whales and dolphins and fish. So fish and anything that lives in the sea has much more value in the ocean doing their job, keeping us alive, than in anyone's plate. There are alternatives to that for most of the people. Maybe some people really rely on fish, but this is a minority. And if we leave the fish only to these people, I think the ocean can be fine. The problem is that you live in Paris, you live in New York, wherever, you want to eat fish, and you want to eat fish often, you know? You don't even think about it. You don't even think about where it comes from.
And not to mention, like you said earlier, we think of it in tons. Like, it's plentiful.
Yeah.
Is there...
Well, we kill billions of fish in such a cruel manner, but we don't even think about it because, you know, in France, sometimes you go to a restaurant and you say you're a vegetarian and they will offer you salmon. I mean, we don't even think of fish as animals. And yet they are individuals and they sense things. They are clever. I mean, I wrote the foreword of a book that's called What a Fish Knows. And anyone who thinks fish equals vegetables should read that. I mean, it's mind-blowing, and it's science, it's scientific, it's all based on science.
So how did you get yourself to make that switch in 2 months to veganism too? Because like there's...
I didn't do it right away.
Okay, because no, that's hard.
It was...
Like I try to do it all the time, and I'm like, I don't know enough.
On the ship it's easy to be vegan because you have vegan cooks. I remember Laura, who was one of our best cooks, she liked to do... special evenings, like this is the Japanese night, the Arab nights, the Italian nights. So for Italian nights, we had pizzas. And I remember thinking, okay, right. Pizza without even cheese. I mean, come on, you know. And she came up with 7 pizzas, all vegan. And man, they were all so good. I was like, how is it even possible? It is possible, but it's so far from our habits. And especially coming from France, you know, the French gastronomy is like all over meat and foie gras and, well, I never liked foie gras, but cheese, you know, so it's hard to make people understand that, hey, you know, no, veganism is not that gloomy, sad diet. No, it can be different.
So take me back to Maru.
Nishin Maru, yeah.
Yeah. Did you know, I mean, you knew in the moment, it sounds like, that you were doing the right thing.
Yeah.
Was it a sense of euphoria afterwards? Like, what did you feel when they turned?
It's like, it's like, you know, you're in the right place, doing the right thing. You're on your right path of life. It's like you found yourself, you know.
What happened to the rest of the expedition? Like after that,
it was very frustrating. I'll tell you why. It's because we ran out of money. We ran out of fuel, and I remember that we shut down the heat on the ship, and we were sleeping with water bottle to keep us warm, because we wanted to stay one more week, and it was very, very, very frustrating. We had to go back to port. At half of the hunting season. So for 2 months, the whales stayed alone with the whalers. And I remember that I was very very mad at Greenpeace that time, because Greenpeace had sent the Esperanza on site. They had raised $40 million on a whaling issue, and the Esperanza just took a picture and went back home. And I was like, damn, you know, So you have the people with the passion and the will to stay, but they don't have the means. And you have people who have the means but don't have the passion and don't really want to stay. So when I came back home in France, I thought, I have to set up Sea Shepherd France, and we have to raise funds and give the Sea Shepherd the means to reach out the level of passion and dedication. This organization deserves more.
How'd you do it?
We started really small. We started doing photocopies of leaflets that we wrote on our computers. We started like a small neighborhood organization, like really paying from our pocket money to make photocopies, really. And I remember we got a box of t-shirts coming from Sea Shepherd USA that we sold the t-shirts. And we start from there. And today we are one of the largest entities of Sea Shepherd.
You guys have a massive following. People are really engaged. You built something. Like, give it, compare it to other sized NGOs. I mean, just France. Just give us some context.
You mean compare?
What's the size? I mean, like, do you guys operate with an annual budget that's, you know, not really?
Okay, yeah. If I give you the budget, then
you don't have to tell me. But I'm just
wondering. I can give you the budget because I think it says a lot. But to compare, Sea Shepherd International is 12 million euros
a year.
Yeah, and Greenpeace International is 350 million a year. So.
And then you guys are France.
But in France we do 1.2 million, so it's not that much actually, you know. The thing is, people think we have money. There are a lot of people who support us, but they don't donate because they think we have money. Why? Because they saw us on TV, because they see the ships, but they don't realize that we have to sacrifice so many campaigns because we don't have enough money to do it. We lead much more campaigns than what we were doing when I joined, right? When I joined, we had one ship and we could stay in port for several months to try to raise funds to pay the oil for the ship. But today, we have a fleet of 13 ships. We do so many campaigns, but we are still in a situation where we have to give up on some issues.
One of those issues is the ongoing battle with the Japanese to stop the killing of mink whales in the Southern Ocean Sanctuary. It's a wildlife refuge, but they don't care. So now it's up to the Australians to enforce it because Sea Shepherd can no longer operate there with any kind of effectiveness. The Japanese fishing vessels that they still call Research are now armed with elusive military equipment that makes them impossible to track. We're going to take a quick sponsorship break, and then on the other side, I catch up with Lamia in Paris. She's prepping for another high-profile campaign against an operation that this time is going to be armed. This episode of Just Dropping In is brought to you by Grovara, a matchmaking service for B2B global wellness. More simply, they help U.S. manufacturers of natural foods, beverages, anything you might see on the shelves of Whole Foods go global.
We created an end-to-end solution that enables American manufacturers to go global. I think just like e-commerce became commerce, doing global business is just going to be doing business.
How did you get your company name?
My last name is Groverman. My co-founder is from Sierra Leone. His last name is Kamara. We combined it, Grovara. And the domain was available.
That domain again? Grovara.com. One of Lamia's biggest challenges is at home, in France. On the western coast, the government is doing little to stop the hundreds of miles of nets that are being set up annually. It's called bycatch because the nets are set up for targeted species, but they end up capturing all marine wildlife. And then it's just discarded. It's a huge problem, and Lamia is doing all she can to draw attention to it.
One of the reasons it keeps going on, it's because it happens at sea, during winter, at night, no witnesses, no one sees, no one knows, no one talks about. So we're going to put the spotlight on that. We're going to put the issue on the table and in the media, and hopefully that will put enough pressure on the French government to make it stop. And if it's not enough, then we'll see what else we can do. But right now we're still in that first stage of action.
What's the plan? Like, how are you going to attack this? Like, what boat are you taking? How many people?
We have a large ship and three small boats that are going to be on the field, and just by being there, we put pressure on the fishermen. Last year we had a big ship for just a couple days, and we documented a net with dolphins inside, and it created a shit storm within
That's what you love, right? You want the shitstorm. That's what you're looking for.
Well, it's necessary. It's the only way to put the issue on the front page, because that's the reason it keeps going on. Again, it's because no one talks about it and no one knows about it. And the fishermen who are guilty of that use methods that they know are going to catch dolphins, and they keep doing it because, well, no one troubles them about it, so they don't care. So yeah, we need a shitstorm to make it stop.
And does this feel any more dangerous or tactically different than other missions out either there or other places you go?
You never know how things can turn up. I mean, we are facing people who can sometimes become very aggressive. There's a lot of money at stake. We're not talking about small fishermen. These are big corporations. And
Who? Do you know the big culprits?
it's we're talking about it's not the only guys who are responsible, but the first ones we are going to target are it's a group of 50 trawlers that belong to big groups, and who have a very detrimental fishing methods.
Are they French?
And most of them are French, but further away offshore, we also have foreign vessels that are concerned, and we are definitely going to look into these ones as well, but in a second stage.
If there's a big corporation that's backing these trawlers, do you try to like name, say, hey, this is a culprit, or is that
Well,
dangerous because there's a bunch of people that are involved?
no, we don't mind giving names, but we need to give names that talk to the public. So when we manage to make links between fishing company and a brand that is familiar to people, then we expose it.
Do they know you're coming? I mean, they know at some point probably you're going to be there.
They must expect us, yeah, because they know we've been there last year, and yeah, they must be expecting us for sure. They don't know for how long we're gonna stay, but they did say that they will get out at sea armed this year in case we come too close to them. So we do expect some tensions. We'll see what's gonna happen. We don't know how far this can go. Obviously, we're not gonna be violent or anything, but we do expect some violence from them.
It's crazy. It's like you're going off to battle. It's really crazy, honestly. And what do you tell everybody to prepare? Like, what do you tell people to do? Like, your crew? Like, what do they take with them? Just a change of clothes? Or do they have like tactical things that they have to take with them? Like, each person plays a role.
No, yeah, well, it's like on a ship. I mean, you have people on deck, people on the bridge, engineers. So everyone has his own duty, but we do brief the whole crew about the mission, the strategy, why we're here, and how what we are trying to achieve, and how we are going to do it. It's important that people understand why they are on board, and what is the objective?
Yeah, there's no pleasure cruise. It's not like you're going out just to see the ocean, like you're going to do work.
Oh yeah, definitely. No, there is always a purpose why we go at sea. It's no pleasure. Well, I would say the mission itself is a pleasure. For me, it's a pleasure to go to Antarctica, to Africa, or anywhere where we feel that we are achieving something, that we are useful. This is the greatest pleasure that I can imagine, really. I would find a pleasure trip quite boring, I think.
Yeah, I'm the same. That's how I approach travel too. Like, if it's not for like storytelling or something like that, I often feel like it's boring. Quick question for you. We learned that Saudi Arabia, the United States, Russia, Kuwait, all were trying to basically damper down the climate change bill. And it just got me thinking how there's just a blow after blow when it comes to like this big kind of fight, not just for climate change, but for marine life. And you remind me a little bit, like when I think about Jane Goodall, doing all that work for like 50 some years, how do you kind of wake up in the morning and stay motivated when there's just blow after blow like that?
Well, I don't know. I don't really think about it. It's just, for me, it's not an option to stop doing it. I mean, I did have other options coming my way, but I don't consider any of them. I don't think I would be more useful anywhere else or doing something else than what I'm doing now with Sea Shepherd. So that's fueling my motivation in a way. I don't even have to think about it really. It's just natural. It's like you just keep working. It's not an option to stop.
There's another piece of the International Whaling Commission agreement that deserves mention, and that's Aboriginal subsistence whaling in places like Barrow, Alaska. Essentially, what it says is that if Aboriginal peoples rely on whaling, they get a pass. But there's a gray area in places like the remote Faroe Islands. That's where in 2014, Lamia led a campaign that drew major international attention. It's all chronicled in a Vice documentary called The Grind, Whaling in the Faroe Islands. It examines the clash between Lamia and the island of 50,000 that stages a centuries-old hunt of pilot whales. And by hunt, I mean going to the sea and pushing pods of pilot whales into the bay to be killed. The film opens with a Faroese man explaining how the water turning red with the blood of dolphins isn't what we think. He says, "We have an outdoor slaughterhouse. In other countries, the slaughterhouses are indoors. There, the blood runs in the sewers. Here, it goes into the sea." He has a point. But listen to how Lamia frames it.
Pilot whales are very, very social creatures. They have very strong bonds with each other. When they are being driven to a killing bay, they wouldn't leave the ones that are injured. They wouldn't abandon them because of those strong bonds. They all die. The killing itself is not the worst part of it. The worst is actually for the last whale to die, because that whale has seen all her family die and they are drowning in each other's blood. This is the worst thing in the Grind.
As Sea Shepherd's campaign continues, tensions begin to mount across the islands.
"You have no business in our islands."
"Well, that's your opinion. You're entitled to it, but we
Next
have the right
year,
to
you're
be
not
here.
Coming into this country."
"Okay, you kick
You
us
are
out."
"Not activists, you are terrorists."
"Okay, that's your opinion."
"Fuck you."
Without giving
Thank
too much
you.
away, I want to jump to another clip towards the end of the film. It's a window into Lamia's ability to see the issue from the other side, to see the humanity of the people, despite her disgust for the practice.
"I know that we drove whales away and that those whales may have been killed if we hadn't. The figures speak for themselves. 1,300 whales died last year, starting June to September, 33 this year. From what I can read in social media, and that they would think that there are 45,000 barbarians here, which is really not the case. People here are among the most hospitable people that I've ever met. Even some of the guys who kill whales are very nice people. I still think that the Grind is barbarian and useless, but I may have changed my perception of why it goes on. I think that the majority of the people who do it just do it out of habit, and it goes back centuries. There are so many traditions here, and I'm just hoping that the day will come where the Faroese people will realize that it doesn't make them less Faroese to drop this one.
It's worth mentioning that the mercury levels are now so high amongst pilot whales that Faroese doctors are advising people not to eat the meat. You wrote Paul Watson's book, correct? Like, you wrote a biography about him?
Yeah, well, it's not a biography. It's more like a discussion of the two of us. And through my questions, I try to give him the opportunity to explain the philosophy and the strategy of Sea Shepherd as clearly as possible for anyone who's who doesn't necessarily understand all the aspects of it.
Paul has been the face for Sea Shepherd for so long. And I know that Peter's really stepped up and you've stepped up. Do you think that it's important to create a new face for Sea Shepherd now?
Well, I think as Paul describes it, Sea Shepherd has become a movement. And of course, it has had the face of Paul for a long time because Paul is what he's the founder and he's such a charismatic person. But he's always tried to put forward all his officers and the campaign leaders, the country directors. And nothing makes him happier to see that other characters are standing forward. I think one of the things that's the most important that he did is he planted seeds in his way. And there are people like myself who would have been involved anyway in the environmental movement because it's something that's close to my heart. But I think it has reached a higher level because I was lucky enough to meet Paul.
That's amazing. And what about you? Because you're kind of doing the same thing now. You started Sea Shepherd France. And can you see some young leaders in France that are wanting to follow in your footsteps?
We do have a group of people who are very involved and very dedicated in France in different manners. I do try to give opportunities to others to give public talks and stuff like that, because it's first of all, I cannot do them all, and
yeah, your baby's probably like, yeah, mom, enough, stay here.
Right, my baby, my boyfriend, my friends. You know, it's the challenge is to keep a personal life, and it's not easy, really. It's not easy.
Your daughter's name is what again? Is it Lulu? Is that what your daughter's name is?
No, Lulu, because my Skype name.
Yeah,
Lulu,
I was like, Lulu is the
Lulu
best.
My dog.
Yeah. Oh, Lulu's your dog.
It's my dog. Yeah. So it's understandable. You can confuse. But no, my daughter's name is Mila.
That's right. Okay. All right. So
she's two, and her first word in French was boat, and the second was baleine, which means whale. I wonder why.
Wow. Yeah. So not mom. Not mom, not dad, but boat and whale.
No. After mom and dad. I mean the common names.
Okay.
The common names. First name was boat, second name was whale.
You know what it's making me think of is that you have a boat named the Steve Irwin, but it reminds me of, you know, how we've seen his kids become such activists. I mean, not just because he passed. That's like, I don't mean to make that like terrible comparison. I just mean that idea of when your parents are just so deeply engrossed in something that they're that passionate about, and then you're 2 years mm-hmm. old and you're already saying boat and whale. It just seems natural that she's already like jumping into the family
right.
business.
Well, and it's funny because at the kindergarten, they said they were saying a story about a fish being eaten by an octopus, being eaten by a shark. And then Mila told them, no eating fish. Yeah. We at home don't put fish in our plates. And we see them as friends, not as food.
You said Mallorca in Africa was you felt like a place that you really could focus your activism on, that French island.
Yeah, not Mallorca, Mayotte.
Mayotte, yeah, that's right. I'm sorry. Do you think that you can actually make change there? I mean, like, is the government that kind of entrenched? Like, how big is that task?
We don't rely on the government, really. We rely on people there. There is a will from people to save the islands. And I think the change will come from people. If we wait for the government, then it will all go to hell before we do anything. But yeah, I do think it's possible. There is hope for Mayotte. There is passion. There is will. There are people who care for the island and who want to fight for it. And I know that since we've been there, they kept doing patrols, even we're gone now, and they are waiting for us to go back next year, and we are even more eager to go back because we see that we encourage them, and they feel that it's not hopeless anymore. We gave them hope, and that's really satisfying for us, and it gives us even more motivation to go back and help them save the island.
When is the last time you told somebody about a trip or like the work that you do that you felt like really, you know, like you were surprised at how emotionally attached you were to it? Whether it be like saying it to your mom or your boyfriend, like when's the last time you talked about a mission or something that you were going to do where you just really felt like, okay, that was...
Well, last week. Last week, we did a...
I didn't expect you to laugh when I asked that question. That's awesome. Go ahead.
We did a small fundraising, and I was talking to people about my yacht, explaining them what we are doing there and what are the objectives, what is the challenge, and how passionate it is. And I'm pretty sure next time will be later this week. Because I have another talk to give, a public talk, so I'm pretty sure I'm gonna have to share that with people, which is always great.
Yeah, I love it. All right, well, thank you for doing this.
You're welcome. Bye bye.